The earth is the foundation of indigenous peoples. It is the well of their spirituality, knowledge, languages, and cultures. It is not a commodity to be bartered to maximize profit, nor should it be damaged by scientific experimentation. The earth is their historian, the cradle of their ancestors' bones. It provides them with nourishment, medicine, and comfort. It is the source of their independence. It is their mother. They do not dominate her, but harmonize with her. This is Conversations for KUAC FM in Fairbanks. I'm Susan McInnes. Those words open a folio on Indigenous peoples and conservation written for Indigenous Survival International. It is a Canadian-based organization of Alaskan, Canadian, and Greenlandic peoples whose primary focus is conservation and sustainable development. Today on Conversations, we talk with David Montour, the Secretary-Treasurer of ISI and an activist for Native rights, including subsistence and the right to participate fully in decision-making relative to conservation and development. David, the first question I want to ask you is too large, and I want to start out by telling you that. If you can just give me your first thoughts on it, then we can kind of filter the question throughout the hour. That first question is, to what extent do you think non-Indigenous peoples really grasp what subsistence and conservation related to subsistence and even Native rights, to what extent do you think we have a handle on that?
I believe the growing awareness of the global environmental crisis will cause non-Native people to wake up and smell the coffee, face reality. It's estimated that we may have less than 40 years to change our behavior, or mankind will have irreparably damaged the environment. And I think that increasingly thinking people will come to realize the important contribution that indigenous people must and can make to the global conservation effort. We're talking about survival of planet Earth. We're talking about very serious issues here, fundamental issues for mankind. And while this may sound a long way from the on-the-ground debate over subsistence issues, it's ironic indeed that one tangent on the environmental theme for Native Alaskans is the growing animal rights movement among urban folks who have mistakenly begun to equate animal rights with environmental awareness, and the two issues are completely removed. Animal rights has nothing whatsoever to do with sound conservation. So it's ironic as hell that you've got urban-based animal rights organizations, which are very sophisticated marketing organizations indeed, who raise a lot of money, attacking the very people who are at the forefront of defending wildlife habitat. I mean, where are the animal rights folks when Native people, the Crees in Canada, are trying to stop a massive James Bay 2 hydroelectric project? Where are the animal rights people when you've got people here in Alaska trying to defend the integrity of the Anwar lands? They're nowhere to be seen.
You've mentioned their limited focus. Can you give us, while we're here, a critique of the animal rights effort?
Well, if one only has to look at the history of the campaigns to ban seal imports into the European community, to realize that animal rights, in fact, for indigenous peoples, certainly in eastern Canada and Greenland, has been actually life-threatening. The incidents of suicide, family breakdown, the kinds of things that happen when you pull the only economic rug out from under a people is absolutely devastating and life-threatening. And it goes far beyond the cash economy derived from a sustainable harvest of sea mammals. It comes right down to a whole range of issues, including nutrition. It's estimated that the replacement value of the wild food consumed in the Northwest Territories alone in Canada is in the order of $50 million. So the consequences of cutting off an indigenous population from its only immediate source of income and spiritual connection with wildlife, the consequences are immense. And these are people living in very fragile environments, requiring extreme care, concern for the wildlife populations. And these people are at the forefront of defending habitat. And who's there to give them the most immediate difficulty? Southern animal rights groups who have never been north of San Francisco or Toronto, who know nothing about the north, its people, its wildlife populations, all of a sudden becoming born-again eco-fundamentalists, and here they think they can preach to us, and we've been preached to enough.
You're listening to David Montour. He's the Secretary-Treasurer of Indigenous Survival International, a Canadian-based organization. Among other activities, it represents Alaskan, Canadian, and Greenlandic peoples, and its primary focus is conservation and sustainable development. To take a look at what your organization does in general terms, can I ask you the what may seem as a ridiculous question? Why is subsistence so vitally important to Indigenous peoples?
Well, subsistence equals survival in Canada for at least 50,000 trappers of Indigenous ancestry and their families. These native trappers tend to have large extended families. The cash income, the wild food consumed is vitally needed for probably a quarter of a million Native Canadians. And that, as I mentioned, includes day-to-day nutrition. I can assure you that even here in Fairbanks, you would not want to pay the price of a box of groceries in Webequay, Ontario, where the only, it's a fly-in community, a place where there are 80 households and 80 trappers, and people who are suffering now great hardship as a direct result of, at least partly as a result of animal rights pressures from urban centers. Now, the difficulties in the fur trade, in fact, have more to do with the glut of ranched fur in the international marketplace and with uncertainty over the economy. However, over the long haul, animal rights organizations could, serve to destroy a subsistence itself. And what is feared is that they'll begin to attack not only the native lifestyle with vicious propaganda, but actually start taking a run at legislators and apply very sophisticated pack-like pressures. And all you have to do is ask the Aleuts of the Pribilof Islands what can happen when these people have their way with legislators. And, of course, if you've got somebody in the Southern 48, it's an easy decision, too easy a decision for a local politician to make. It affects people thousands of miles away and, gets them a few votes from his yuppie constituents.
Well, not to minimize the impact of the animal rights movement, but subsistence seems threatened certainly by other forces, urban incursion, the fluctuating and sometimes endangered economies of village peoples. Can you also speak to that?
Well, we were through a debate like that in Canada over the proposed Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, and the Dene people of the Northwest Territories organizing themselves to mount an effective advocacy in the halls of power in southern Canada. And subsistence was at the center and at the... which subsistence was, in fact, the basis of it was the essence of the Dene culture. And you cut off those people from a relationship of reciprocity with wildlife, from its freshwater fishery, from the fur bearers, and what is left? I mean, it's a complete marginalization of a people. If access to subsistence lifestyle is to be cut off, it would be the end result, in fact, and I don't think genocide is too tough a word in this instance, the end result will be the disappearance of a viable culture dependent on a sustainable harvest of wildlife. And if you look at the world today, you know, we lose... sitting in Ottawa and Washington and elsewhere, we lose sight of the reality of how the majority of the world's population and rural parts of the world live. I mean, it's a highly interdependent relationship with wildlife for the most part. And it's ironic, those debates go right out the window, or that understanding of how most people in this world live seems to fly by the wayside, just with the impact of television and so on.
It seems to me that, and I'm going to make kind of a bold generalization and then allow you to critique it, if you will, that among dominant Western cultures, there is a dissociation with the land in the first place, with, as your folio calls it, Mother Earth. But secondly, it seems that we also dissociate ourselves from our own ancestry. We tend to think of ourselves more as white urban female, black or Afro-American urban female, Hispanic rural male, then we tend to think of ourselves as coming from a Scottish ancestry of cultural values, for example, in my own case. If you agree with that, do you think that that is one of the blocks in the road to understanding between indigenous peoples and the Western culture?
I think this loss of identity is one of the reasons for this quest for some sort of quasi-environmental or ecological new world. We're talking about some people who would actually put wildlife and indigenous people in a similar category, almost in some kind of mythical zoo. Mm. And they themselves no longer know who they are, have become alienated from the land, alienated from even farm animals. So I think it's a loss of their identity, and unfortunately, in seeking to find out who they are and joining organizations with a sort of rigorous doctrine like animal rights, they, you know, as I say, the born-again scenario is not too far removed, because then there's also this urge, now that they've recovered, now they got to preach, now they got to impose their will on someone else who is not as easily able to defend themselves from this new wave of colonialism. Well, it's a new wave of colonialism.
You keep returning to animal rights. Do you consider it the major threat at this point?
Well, in the... I return to this because of the subsistence reality here in rural Alaska, and I'm concerned that in some cases our own more isolated communities have not yet come to understand in total the danger presented by these organizations, because they're people who are living very well in their relationship with wildlife, and to them animal rights doesn't make any sense,
mm-hmm.
either conservation sense or any sense in terms of you know, mankind's place in the whole ecosystem. Animal rights are so detached from that worldview, and I just returned to the animal rights agenda because I think it is a serious issue for isolated native communities, very serious. And unfortunately, and the larger reality is that if we don't address the global environmental crisis very soon, we won't have the luxury of debating animal rights or even human rights.
Mm. How do you think that indigenous peoples can guide the people of this planet towards both understanding and taking steps to repair the environmental crisis?
Well, I think we have a major responsibility as the small nations of this world to show leadership in the global conservation effort. I think the indigenous conservation ethic is now more than ever increasingly relevant, needed, and it's about time that ethic is recognized. And finally, at last, you have developments like the Brundtland exercise, Brundtland Commission, World Commission on Environment and Development, which essentially took steps to get international agreement on the concept of sustainable development, sustainable future. And really all it was a the so-called countries, the Western countries belonging to the North, realizing that cooperation, you know, the North-South debate had to focus on the environmental integrity of the planet very soon. But all it really was a confirmation of what is essentially the indigenous conservation ethic, formalized by nation states, now leading into a major United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Brazil in 92. I think as Native people we must take the responsibility to use the vehicle of that conference to be heard. It's also coincidentally 500 years since the 92 will be the 500-year quincentenary of the first voyage of Christopher Columbus to the Americas. And while we don't feel any great urge to celebrate that event, I think we can turn around the situation and push for a recognition of the indigenous people's agenda of survival. And while we're at it, turn around the Columbus events into a celebration of a renaissance of the First Nations of the Americas. And I think it is the conservation ethic of indigenous people that will probably open doors for us if we are skillful and articulate. I think it's a once-in-500-year opportunity.
Can you describe for our listeners what you mean when you say indigenous conservation ethic?
Well, let me put it in the simplest terms. My own Iroquoian people, in describing a relationship with nature, would use a simple example. When you put a drinking vessel into the water, into a stream, to take a drink of water, you always move the vessel in the same direction as the current, out of respect for the nature of things. That kind of sensitivity to the consequences of what you do in that ecosystem, you know, the fact that you flow with nature, you don't try to control it, you learn where you stand as a participant in that ecosystem, where you stand as a predator, and man is a predator, no doubt about it. But that relationship within nature is understood and respected, and there are, knowledge of indigenous people of the traditional knowledge is substantial, and it's an incredible opportunity for Western science, if Western science is prepared to drop its arrogance of the past and listen to traditional people. There's a whole new world, I'm sure, of potential there for the health of mankind, new medicines, new to white scientific worldview, but, you know, not new to people practicing their traditional relationship with nature. It never ceases to amaze me how Western scientists can go to Brazil and think they've discovered a new species of tree frog, and here, of course, and even give it a new nomenclature within the scientific system of classification, and maybe name it after his uncle and so on. But, of course, these species have been in use for thousands of years, perhaps for medicine, by the indigenous peoples of these regions. One of the ironies of Western science is that, I've heard the United Nations Environmental Program predict that out of some 5 million plus species, known species in the world today, one species per day is being lost. It would take something like in the order of 100,000 professional lifetimes of scientists to even categorize or inventory the Earth's natural resources. In other words, we don't even know what we're losing
because
we don't even know what mysteries the Earth still holds for us. And it's one of the ironies of the Western scientific worldview. It tends to be quantitative in its analysis. The indigenous traditional knowledge is more qualitative, more holistic. It sees the longer-term picture over many generations, as opposed to a biologist counting hairs and the relationship of that year's hair count with the population of lynx. The indigenous trapper would look at a whole number of other issues, water quality and so on.
Can the laboratory and the trapper coexist? Can those two universes of knowledge complement each other?
Oh, I believe that it's only on the ground in the trapper's world where you're dealing with the real world. To try to come up with computer models of certain biological events and so on, I think we're a long way from that kind of scientific success. But, you know, it's going to take a lot of healing and a lot of trust between traditional peoples and the Western scientific worldview. Too often, state biologists are only viewed as people coming in to police them or to impose the state's will on the native individual. And those old attitudes have to change, or you're not going to see a significant willingness on the part of native people to pass on their knowledge.
We're talking with David Montour today. You're listening to Conversations. David Montour was born on Six Nations Reserve in Ontario. Since 1985, he has been working with indigenous survival international. He is their secretary treasurer. That's equivalent to the duties of the executive director. ISI, once again, is an alliance of indigenous peoples of Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. Its primary focus is conservation and sustainable development. Does ISI work, for example, with wildlife biologists and the people in villages to try and make a mesh there that might activate at some time in the future?
Well, we're hoping to work in the future systematically with serious conservation organizations such as the World Wildlife Fund in Canada. The co-chairman of ISI Canada is on the board of directors of World Wildlife Fund. We've had a Greenlander on the governing council of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. We have a serious conservation agenda to get on with. And unfortunately, there are many distractions and a lot of it having to do with fighting off bans on trade bans on fur products in Europe and defending subsistence. And it takes a lot of our time and energy. And quite frankly, we think the real issue is getting on with a very serious conservation agenda.
On the subject of subsistence, it again, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that indigenous peoples are pretty much given a peculiar either-or choice. You can go back completely to your ancient life ways or embrace the dominant culture and economy. In your mind or in the organization's mind, is there some sort of balancing way of life? It seems to me both difficult in 1991 and beyond to go back solely to an ancient life and to give up those ancient ways entirely.
I don't believe it's an either-or situation. I think the subsistence lifestyle is demanding enough of the individual. The weather alone, the vastness of the territory alone, the safety prerogatives requires modern equipment, and indigenous people have every right to use modern technology. We're a very adaptive people and would not have survived otherwise. You know, you've got people and some of them even in the more serious animal welfare environment who think they can dictate to legislators or set themselves up as experts on what is in fact traditional subsistence, and try to tell legislators that you can't put a zipper on a marine mammal parka because it's no longer a, quote, traditional garment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got that kind of, in fact, I even heard that from a Greenpeace advocate during a debate on the sea otter here in Alaska. That kind of imposing of another society's will on subsistence people is just not sound conservation.
Doesn't it indicate the level of, I'm not sure whether fear is the right word, certainly distress on the part of others who would use the subsistence ecology, whether it's legislators, developers, commercial fishermen, sports hunters? These seem to be the lobbying groups lined up against subsistence.
Well, I don't know if it's fear as much as the same old story over who gets what, when, where, why, and how, in the end, how they lose it.
The pie is only so big and I want my piece?
Exactly. And these other groups tend to be have more resources, or closer to the TV cameras, or have powerful allies, like, the, say, the National Rifle Association, or, on the other hand, powerful environmental groups like Greenpeace. I mean, you know, in Toronto, I had a debate with the head of Greenpeace Canada, and, you know, he has an office and staff of 30 people, and that's just their Toronto office, and they've got Montreal and Vancouver offices. Can you imagine what our organization could do with if we could even come anywhere near a staff of 30 people? I mean, we've got virtually a circumpolar conservation agenda here to get on with, and we don't have anywhere near the resources and nor the time to raise money at that kind of hyped level that they work at. And, I mean, we've been pretty frank with them that in some ways we consider them environmental hypocrites, because they use all of the lip service of Chief Seattle and of the Rainbow Warrior, you know, in their hard sell. But when it comes to their own conflict with Native people, they've been as ruthless in some cases as all the others. So we've been pretty frank with Greenpeace, and in the end, we were able to neutralize them on the fur issue in Canada and in the UK.
Is it mostly the fur issue that makes you come to loggerheads with Greenpeace, or are there other issues on your agendas that battle with each other?
Well, there are areas of potentially mutual cooperation in the future, and I think we'll probably agree to agree on a future an agenda. At the point, Greenpeace will only admit that they do not have a policy on fur. In other words, they don't want to talk about it. Mm. They don't want to compromise their, quote, market. If they are seen, you know, maybe some fear that if they support an indigenous wild fur harvest or sustainable harvest, that they're somehow losing their environmental integrity. Well, the fact is, the most common sense conservation is a sustainable harvest by indigenous people.
And do you think the dominant cultures of the world can come to agreement on your thinking regarding sustainable harvest? The question again is, do you think that there is a cooperative future?
Oh, I think most serious conservation bodies in the world have already come to that conclusion. The Brundtland Commission report talked about the need to empower indigenous peoples. The IUCN supports a sustainable use of wildlife. The World Wildlife Fund clearly behind our identifying habitat destruction as the critical issue for wildlife in the future. What bothers us is the abuse of major international forums like CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or the IUCN, where you've got massive international conferences, thousands of delegates, animal rights organizations using the rules of the conference to cover the costs of delegates from poor countries who don't know the species or the peoples involved, encouraged to pass resolutions over which, you know, they don't have the scientific data and so on, and moving up, aggressively promoting a animal rights agenda in international forums. And then what they hope to do is polarize opinion within those international bodies and then progressively put pressure on the leadership of those international conservation bodies to, you know, black and white, where do you stand, pro-trapping or not? And that's what they do. They polarize opinion, raise the level of debate to either or. The tactics are not unlike both sides in the abortion debate.
That's what I was just thinking. It sounds like it's your abortion issue.
It becomes that emotional and that hardened. And, I mean, we got a tough time ahead of us from the animal rights community, but the serious conservationists, the serious animal welfare organizations, I think will become increasingly cooperative and indeed realize that there is a contribution to be made by indigenous people, and in fact it's now time for them to start listening to us.
What do you think? It's another huge question, so answer any part of it you wish to. What do you think has to be done in the world to save the world beyond 40 years for our future generations, for all of us? What do we have to do first and most importantly?
Well, there are profound environmental changes within existing nation states. Who would have thought there would have been a unification of the Germanys 36 months ago? Look what is the dynamics of the Soviet Union. Canadians are often smug, but I think the changes in the future for Canada are as profound as those of the Soviet Union. I mean, it's not just the French-English debate. The indigenous people's position in the Canadian Federation is going to come to the forefront. So the political cultures of the world and the realignment of the world into major blocks, I mean, Europe in 1992, a powerful block of 336 million people. I mean, that's, you know, pretty powerful consensus if they are prepared to do something. That's a real opportunity. So maybe the world, in some instances, will be better organized to make profound changes. In other instances, societies will be hamstrung on implementing political decisions for change.
We have the whole emerging Eastern Europe with its tremendous problems of pollution.
The horror stories from Eastern Europe are... we're only now beginning to hear some of those horror stories. I mean, the we've got whole ecosystems in Eastern Europe, maybe damaged for all times, you know, toxic chemicals and so on. We also mustn't feel smug in the circumpolar region, because the circumpolar is acting like a sink for a whole range of airborne toxic substances and so on. Just because we've got a lot of space doesn't mean that we're not going to be profoundly affected by, you know, pollutants from the south. And it's not just a pollution of some ideas. It's very real toxic threat here. I think international cooperation and mutual interest are what must be the new survival process. The world is so interrelated, be it trade or exchange of ideas or this day and age. It's ironic, you know, when we have all the modern tools of communications and so on, that we can't get our act together. On the other hand, maybe now we'll realize we have no choice.
There is a marvelous advantage to global cooperation between the native states. And on the other hand, it also seems that where there are treaties and laws and regulations made internationally, that often the local issues, the local needs, for example, the needs of a small rural community or of a village of indigenous peoples, are forgotten. It's like the... it's like the decision is too big to encompass the small group. Do you perceive that as a danger?
Prime example of that is the migratory birds debate, Mexico, Canada, U.S., and the International Convention. Well, Canada is so constitutionally constipated right now that there's some question as to whether Canada can even implement an amendment to the Migratory Birds Treaty because of the division of power between the federal government and the provinces.
To translate, constitutionally constipated.
Well, in Canada, we're locked in a a debate over whether Quebec stays within Canada or leaves. There's a big debate over the status of Indian self-government, whether there'll be constitutional provisions in the Canadian state in the future for a third level of government. In other words, the federal government, the provinces, and the Indian government, the whole debate over collective rights.
We don't know who we are, so how can we deal with birds? Is that sort of it?
Well, just a division of powers. Yeah. I mean, migratory birds will come down to whether who has the jurisdiction. Will it be Indian governments and co-management with the provinces and federal authorities? I mean, what will the alignments look like in the future? Mm-hmm. Notwithstanding Canada's own problems on migratory birds, on the one hand, say you have the Cree and James Bay sitting on the where the birds nest, in the James Bay lowlands. Well, you've got two forces in the southern 48 states diametrically opposed who want a piece of the action too. On the one hand, you've got roughly the forces represented by the very powerful American Rifle Association and, you know, the hunting lobby,
hunters, yeah,
which, you know, wants their birds, and you've got well-organized animal welfare bodies as well, two diametrically opposed. Now, did they both get their way with the Canadian government, and are the Crees the last in line in terms of access? You know, those are the sort of hemispheric questions that I think that's one example to
sure
cover exactly what you've said. Look at the debate over International Whaling Commission, and look at how the people who need whales for subsistence, the Greenlanders and the Alaskans, look how they, the traditional peoples, have been cut out of those the international whale conservation debate, and the kind of games that are played in those international forums, the kind of treacheries and the kind of trade-offs that occur, cutting off access for indigenous peoples, and it's, you know, for subsistence.
Once again, we're talking with David Montour. You're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM, and I'm your host, Susan McInnes. Before joining Indigenous Survival International, Mr. Montour worked with the Assembly of First Nations from 1982 to 1985. He has also been, in his history, a senior advisor on corporate policy for Indian and Northern Affairs in Canada. This is Conversations. Relative to that point, I'll throw a number of examples in a basket and ask you if you think that they are part of the exclusion of Indigenous peoples from decision-making. Recently in Oregon, a Native American man was arrested for catching a Chinook salmon in a river. He was fined $2,500 and given a year in jail. There is a village of people, or actually two villages of people in Alaska, who have said, despite the state's regulations, that they will hunt caribou. The state is regulating caribou at this time, believing that there aren't enough to hunt. Native peoples are saying they will anyway. In the last year, Mohawks in Canada battled with the Canadian Mounties over a piece of land that the white community wanted to turn into a golf course, and the Mohawk people said was not only suitable for a golf course, but was their land to determine. Are these issues that come out as law-breaking examples from the Western perspective merely in your mind, or substantively in your mind, incidences of people who are not being represented by their own governments saying, if I'm not represented, I will represent myself, however violently or however against the law I need to do it? And do you think it's going to happen more in the future?
Well, you know, you've got such state hypocrisy involved in each of those instances. I mean, what about, I understand from reading the paper here in Alaska that there's some debate over salmon in the Columbia River system becoming extinct. Well, who created that situation? It certainly wasn't those Indian people in the north west. In the case of Caribou in Alaska, well, those same people who would impose their will on those caribou hunters, what are they doing about Anwar? In the case of the Mohawks at Oka, it wasn't just the RCMP, it was the Canadian Army. It was an incredible show of force in the context of an Indian demonstration in Canada. I guess in the future, what we're look at least in Canada, we've got an explosive situation. Things are probably, unfortunately, going to get worse before they get better. And we've had a recent setback just in the last month or so with a decision in the British Columbia court over a major land claim, which suggested that the Indian people's claim to that piece of land in British Columbia was simply superseded by law when British Columbia joined Canada. You know, we've got a national museum of civilization in Ottawa, which proudly displays the totems of the Northwest Coast, and you know, has no question being First Nations, right in the nation's capital. And here you've got a provincial court suggesting that those people don't have any collective right to that territory in British Columbia.
Do the old treaties have to be enforced, and can they be in this day and age?
Well, unfortunately, the reality has been that the white man's treaties weren't worth the paper they were written on. I don't know of any that haven't been broken. I don't know of one Indian community in Canada which hasn't had land alienated from its territories with or in the absence of a treaty. I guess that's one reason I tend to focus on the environment as an issue which has the potential of capturing everyone's imagination and perhaps people beginning to demand of their governments that the indigenous question be addressed in a fair and timely manner, and that, you know, we need these people, and there's something to be learned from indigenous people. I still, however, am an optimist and believe that we've, you know, it's the best of times, the worst of times. I do think, though, we do have a unique opportunity in 1992 for a whole lot of reasons to begin to turn around a particularly rough experience historically into something very positive for the good of mankind.
Do you need the alignment with your issue of other competitors for the land and its resources?
Well, if only out of mutual interest, I'm sure we can get other so-called user groups to agree that habitat should be defended. In other words, let's both work together to defend habitat, and then maybe we can work out a compromise or a dialogue on access. But first, we got to protect the habitat. Or the other debate is just a mute debate. There's no more, if the habitat is destroyed. I mean, if the Columbia River salmon are gone, what's the point of the debate at that point?
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Can you give us some idea of what Indigenous Survival International does, the scope of your work, the kinds of efforts you're making towards this aim of yours?
Well, we hope that we have established a dialogue with the institutions of the European communities on fur and marine mammals, and we hope that the European Parliament and institutions like it have become sensitized to the plight of the Indians of the world, if you will. In fact, there was recently, in the last 2 years, a report to the European Parliament on the conditions of the world, world's Indian people or indigenous people. We're going to have to secure the assets and the resources, assets human and financial, to begin to have an impact on Brazil in 1992. It's going to be a tough uphill battle. You've got a big public relations scenario for governments. You're going to have governments, nation-state positions firm on issues, be it water or global warming, deals essentially cut between blocks even before people arrive at the conference. You're going to be in competition with literally thousands of non-governmental organizations for attention of the world media. They see it as a media event opportunity. It's a meeting of being held simultaneously in three major Brazilian cities. It'll be probably the biggest conference ever held in history. And, you know, how do we avoid being lost in the crowd? Mm-hmm. Well, I think coming full circle, we can probably get support from a very powerful European bloc if we continue to follow up on some of our work on sensitizing the European community. Coming back to the fur debate, we have made friends in the European community. That offers some potential. 1992, Sevilla, the World's Fair, Barcelona, the Olympics, media attention of hundreds of millions of people. You know, can we come up with strategies to make simple, common sense environmental statements in those international forums and begin to capture the attention of the world, the imagination of serious environmental thinkers in the world? So I think we've got some opportunities. We're outgunned, outnumbered. There'll be diversions, no doubt, in competing for attention with, ironically, again, our old animal rights friends and some issues. But we've got to make an honest effort.
In addition to capturing the imagination and concern of the public in general and of governments in specific, what do you consider to be the, I suppose, the strength of the army poised against you, or perhaps in the long run, the strength of the possible alliances with the development community? You mentioned ANWR. It is probably a patch of land that is going to be developed in the next decade. You also mentioned the James Bay Hydroelectric Project that can be environmentally damaging and damaging to indigenous peoples. Where are developers on your list of concern?
Well, there are some signs that the management, that modern management science is recognizing that conservation, the conservation ethic, is more profound than just the cost of doing business, that in fact it is just good, sound management. And that if a corporation is to survive, its planning must be long-term, it must be holistic, and that there are other variables other than profit only in the long-term health of a corporate entity. So there are some changes underway in the corporate culture. In some cases, government is already falling behind. In Canada, we have a number of businesses which are taking, which have seen real opportunity in recycling and marketing environmentally friendly products. It's just simply good business. So there's some encouraging signs there. The greening of the, you know, MBA room is not that far off in some cases, simply because it's common sense in the long run, common sense business. Also, I think the business and the banking institutions, which in Canada in particular are very powerful, are uncomfortable with uncertainty. and it's uncertainty over land claims issues, uncertainty over issues of environmental integrity, which would even cause them to put pressure on governments to get these things negotiated and out of the way so that perhaps a sustainable development agenda can result. So there are some signs there. I think a lot of it will come down also to young people today being a little more aggressive, a little more articulate in how they want to live than our generation was. And I'm encouraged by young people I meet anyway, having their heads screwed on, let's say, a little tighter than we may have in our day. And, there is an opportunity. We don't have much time, but I would like to think the world is in for some profound changes in its thinking. Well, indeed, it has no choice.
Do you see leaders coming from within the indigenous peoples community among young people?
I'm very impressed and very encouraged with the young Native people I'm meeting who, of course, have had an opportunity now for more experiences, travel, education, who have the advantage of, electronic media. It's not all a, the awareness of these young people is astounding compared to what I thought I knew when I was younger. I have no doubt whatsoever that we have a number of young people, Native people in Canada, who, must and have a responsibility to take on cabinet posts in future governments, and who have the skills, who have the discipline, and who have the drive to do that kind of thing. I know a number of people right now who can certainly do a better job than some of the people we have in the driver's seat at this time.
And do you think it's crucial that Native peoples participate in government, in wildlife management through the government, even in development issues, so that way of thinking can be brought to?
Well, we shouldn't be ghettoized on the fringes of, certain programs which observers might deem the most relevant, either in Indian affairs or environmental affairs. Mm. We've got to be right at the center of machinery of government. We have to get right to the chromosomes, the genes of what makes institutions tick. We've got to take all our institutions as Native people. We've got to put them under a microscope and crank up the power and really take a look at what's wrong with society and get in there and make our contributions right at the center of the society, not just on the fringes. I mean, we've been marginalized far, far too long.
David Montour, I want to thank you for a very interesting hour. To remind people as we close, David Montour is the Secretary Treasurer, that's an equivalent to the Executive Director, of the Indigenous Survival International. It is based in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Its focus is Indigenous peoples and sustainable development. You've been listening to An Hour with David Montour. I'm Susan McGuinness, and this has been Conversations. I hope you'll join us again next week.